Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Tonight, there has been another victim.
The investigation into the high school massacre is slow-moving and dangerous.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News.
Crime. Together we'll crack it.
Now I am the commander.
It's mysterious, it's deadly, and it's baffling medical science.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Good evening. December 11th may go down as the day of the biggest robbery in our country's history, and it happened right here in New York. Somewhere between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport. And the law enforcement officers say that it was carried off with such precision and such daring, you almost have to consider it an inside job.
The first title card that appears on screen in the 1990 Martin Scorsese movie Goodfellas states, "This film is based on a true story." And I guess, for all intents and purposes, it really is. The movie was written by Scorsese himself, along with Nicholas Pileggi. Its concept was derived from Pileggi's 1985 true crime biography about the gangster Henry Hill. I absolutely adore this movie. Scorsese is a master director and filmmaker, and Goodfellas is easily one of his best pictures. I recently treated myself to a copy of the movie on 4K and watched it again with friends. It's incredible. But that title card at the start got me thinking. Whilst the characters in the movie are wonderful and brilliantly portrayed by a great cast, it got me thinking about the true life events that featured at the heart of the movie, and in particular, a key set of scenes in the third act. I'm talking about the infamous Lufthansa heist. The heist was a real-life robbery carried out by members of Italian and Irish organized crime figures on December 11, 1978. A mafia hit that involved members of the Lucchese, Gambino and Bonanno crime families. The hit was on the German Lufthansa airline facilities at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. Some $5 million in cash was stolen during the robbery, and $875,000 worth in jewellery, worth roughly $28 million in 2024 monetary equivalency. At the time, it was the biggest cash heist in American history, only surpassed in 1997 with a $19 million Dunbar heist in Los Angeles, and then the subsequent $30 million Gardaworld heist, also in Los Angeles, in 2024. The Lufthansa heist has been immortalized in the movie Goodfellas, along with a few other lesser-known movies. But none of these works tell the full and accurate story about what actually happened in the early morning hours of December the 11th, 1978. In Goodfellas and other interpretations of the story, multiple real-life people who were involved in the incident were combined into single characters, and specific events were omitted altogether. Scorsese does show the actual heist happening, as the picture is told from the perspective of Henry Hill, who was not directly involved with the heist, it has to be said. But it does explain the events and show the aftermath. But here tonight is what really happened, and also the story of the real-life bloody aftermath, where almost everyone that was part of the crew were either murdered or disappeared without a trace. One character, who is completely omitted from the Goodfellas narrative, is the only person that was ever convicted for their role in the heist. His name was Lewis Werner, and he was the inside man for the robbery. Werner worked for Lufthansa at JFK Airport. He was employed as a cargo supervisor. By 1978, he had been employed by the airline for more than 10 years. Part of Werner's job role included meeting the planes when they arrived at JFK and taking possession of any valuables that were being transported on board, such as cash or jewellery. Times were different back then. The world wasn't a digital place. Cash was still manually transported. And the jewellery was on the plane because it was being delivered to different buyers and sellers across the globe, while the cash was the outcome of the airline's currency exchange services overseas. Each day, Werner could see these valuables arrive, and he would transport them from the plane into the cargo building, where they would be placed securely inside the airline's vault. Following the vault placement of valuables, an armored vehicle would collect the valuables at the same time and on the same day. Equally structured days. It was consistent and thoroughly planned. Who knows how Werner wondered or dreamed what would happen if some of this cash would suddenly disappear as he did his job. But we do know that he did think about these things at least once. And that thought was strong enough to act upon. In Nicholas Pileggi's work, Wise Guy, Henry Hill described Lewis Werner as a, quote, degenerate gambler trying to support his estranged wife on a $300 a day gambling habit and with a $15,000 a year salary, unquote. Werner had a lot of debt, and he wasn't a very successful gambler. His debts were not the sort that could be solved by filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and walking away. Werner was up to his neck, so to speak. By 1978, Werner owed around $18,000 to various bookies and loan sharks across New York. His life was in danger. He needed to find money quick if he was going to survive. But the actual genesis for the infamous heist actually began 2 years earlier, on October 8, 1976. A simple impulse on a normal working day for Werner. A plane had just arrived from Germany and its cargo was a particularly large amount of foreign currency. Werner met the plane upon arrival, as normal. Back in 76, he was also in a lot of debt, though different debts to 2 years later. He was again desperate. He entered the container which contained the currency, and then things seemingly disappeared. Werner's official story was that he had come down with a bad case of diarrhea on that particular day and quickly needed to use a restroom. After about 10 minutes, the cash that was sitting on the runway and surrounded by dozens of colleagues was taken back to the cargo terminal by Werner. Its contents would be inventoried, though by that point it was discovered that a cardboard box containing $22,000 in mostly German currency had seemingly vanished. As the person in charge of taking custody of the cargo, Werner was suspected of stealing the money and was blamed for failing to secure the cargo. But Werner stuck to his story about having diarrhea, and following a search, none of the missing cash was found on him or in the airport. Werner was not arrested, and after receiving a warning, he also got to keep his job. But Werner really did steal the money, of course. A friend and co-worker of his, by the name of Peter Grunewald, had hidden the cash for Werner. He did so because Werner promised him a rather sweet $5,000 after they had exchanged it for US dollars. Neither man was fully aware of what they had got themselves into, however. But they knew that they needed to get rid of any evidence and fast. So Werner and Grunewald took the cardboard box that the money was transported in and cut it into small pieces. They then drove around Long Island all night disposing of each piece in a different dumpster so that nothing would ever be found or linked back to them. Next, they figured out how to exchange the money for US currency without drawing any suspicion. $22,000 was a huge amount of money in 1976, and an exchange of that amount would draw alarm bells, not to mention the exact amount being stolen suddenly being transferred in the same area of the theft would allow authorities to draw suspicion, shall we say. Grunewald and Werner did some simple research, however, and they discovered that as long as each exchange was less than $500, it did not need to be reported to the US Treasury. Great news, the pair thought. Werner was still under heavy suspicion, though, so the pair arranged for a third party that couldn't be linked to either man to carry out the exchanges at various different banks across New York City. That third party was named William Fischetti, the boyfriend of Werner's estranged wife. 45 exchanges in total of around $495 per exchange. It took a few days, as you can imagine, but no ID was needed currency exchanges in those days, and it went without a hitch. Ultimately, everything worked out for Werner and his associates. Werner paid his wife the back support money he owed her and paid his associates what he promised them. Then the degenerate gambler paid off his debts to the bookies he owed money to. He also got to keep his job, something he hadn't anticipated. Werner managed to solve a lot of problems in his life with this one simple action, and he got away with a perfect crime. Good for him. He was given the chance to start over afresh with a blank slate and turn his life around. But do you think he took the opportunity? No, he really was a degenerate. Instead, he continued to gamble, and in less than 2 years, he went from zero to $18,000 in debt yet again. Whilst the average person may have thought, phew, that was a close call, I better sort my life out now. After that first robbery, Werner instead thought, I did it once, I can do it again, and any time I need to do it. So he was going to steal from his employer once again. Of course, he couldn't use the same ploy a second time. But if he could orchestrate a much larger robbery of the cargo vault, then he could make much more money, he thought. Maybe even enough to take care of him for the rest of his life. Greed really is a terrible beast. So anyway, the two friends, Lewis Werner and Peter Grunewald, started thinking of a plan in the spring of 1978. Grunewald immediately saw the potential financial windfall that they could achieve. $5,000 was not worth going to prison and losing his job for, however. It was peanuts for that kind of risk, he thought. So in Grunewald's mind, they would need to steal at least $1 million, minimum. The pair shook hands and agreed to a plan to make it happen. Grunewald's job was to put together the robbery team, while Werner, being at the supervisor level at Lufthansa Airlines, gave him detailed knowledge of alarm systems in the terminal along with the staff procedures. He was the inside man. His role was to develop the plan and provide a detailed layout of the building with the information to the heist team, including details of the alarm. But Grunewald was unable or unwilling to commit. He got cold feet. The heist was just looking too big for him. But Werner was desperate. He had to do this. His life depended on it happening once again. But as the year went on, progress was very slow. The bookies were getting more and more aggressive and wanted their money. Werner had no choice and decided to conduct the robbery without his friend. Now, many of the bookies that Werner owed money to rarely interacted with Werner directly, unless they were making threats for their money, of course. After Werner received an extremely threatening phone call from one of his creditors, a creditor with direct mafia ties, I might add, Werner reached out to Frank Manner. Manner was a go-between for Werner and the bookies. After hearing Werner's heist idea, Manner promised to take it up with his boss, Martin Krugman. Krugman, unbeknownst to Werner, was the same man that had just made the threatening phone call to Werner. The wheels were now in motion, though no one at this point realized just how big this would end up becoming. But also, no one involved would realize that by taking part in the heist, they would immediately sign their death warrants. Organized crime is like the food chain. At the very bottom are the average Joe customers, powerless folks who use the services provided by the criminals. These were people like Lewis Werner. Next up, there are the gangsters on the lowest level, those who do the legwork for their employers. Frank Manner, the go-between that Werner reached out to with his heist idea, lurked on this rung of the ladder. Above Manner was Martin Krugman. Krugman was a Jewish-American businessman who sold wigs and other men's hair care products across New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. He also operated an illegal bookmaking firm behind the scenes. In the movie Goodfellas, this person was characterized as Maury Kessler, played by Chuck Law. He was a fairly harmless but whiny character in the movie. The real-life Krugman was far from this character, however. As far as organized crime hierarchy goes, Krugman was also fairly close to the bottom. But just above him was his friend and associate, Jimmy Burke. Burke was made famous being played by Robert De Niro in Martin Scorsese's Picture. His character was named Jimmy Conway. Scorsese had to change the character's name when writing the script after Burke's family demanded substantial financial compensation for allowing his name rights to be used. The number was said to be in the six figures, so the studio balked at the request. Did the studio really think that a hustler's family wasn't going to hustle? Anyway, Burke could be extremely charming and friendly. He was given the nickname locally as Jimmy the Gent. He was also extremely generous to those around him. Though make no mistake, James Burke was also nothing short of a psychopath. Writing in Wise Guy, Henry Hill described him as, quote, "someone you could have a dinner full of great conversation and laughter with, but when dessert came, he would not hesitate to shoot you in the back of the head as you glanced away," unquote. James Burke was a chameleon. Burke often did business with Martin Krugman and loaned him money, but he did not like the man at all. Krugman was stingy, negative, and claimed that he simply could not pay the high interest rates that Burke demanded. Burke considered the low-level bookmaker to be a two-faced liar, however. Krugman's chain of men's hair care stores would air commercials on television late at night.
"Don't buy wigs that come off at the wrong time. Maury's wigs don't come off, even underwater. And remember, Maury's wigs are tested against hurricane winds. Don't forget about money. You can afford a Maury wig, priced to fit every budget. So call me now."
That was the movie version of said commercial. The reality wasn't far different. Burke was an insomniac who watched late-night TV often, and every time one of Krugman's adverts came on, he would be enraged that Krugman could afford to produce TV advertising, yet claim that he couldn't afford Burke's loan interest payments. Though for now, Krugman did earn money for Burke, so he was tolerated and useful. Krugman immediately saw the potential of the Lufthansa heist, and right away he took the idea to Jimmy Burke for his consideration. Among Burke's many illicit businesses, his speciality was hijacking. Henry Hill claimed that Burke loved nothing more than stealing. Burke operated his headquarters out of a bar which he owned in Queens called Robert's Lounge. It was some of the bar's regulars who were part of Burke's criminal crew. One of these men was Joe Manri. His last name was actually Manriquez, but he concealed his Hispanic heritage and posed instead as an Italian. He hoped that by doing so, he could become a made member of the Lucchese crime family one day. Manri was very overweight with a huge beer gut that earned him the nickname Buddha. Burke liked Krugman's heist idea. They agreed that in exchange for the tip-off, Krugman would receive a fee of 10% minus the debt that he already owed Burke. Think of this as a sort of finder's fee. Burke then directed Manri to get in touch with Lewis Werner and work out all the details of the plan. Burke wanted to ascertain just how feasible the robbery was in reality. Manri was the only connection that Werner would have between himself and the crew that was to carry out the heist. The less Werner knew about who was involved, the better it would be for everyone. This was something that both Burke and Werner both thought. Werner was very detailed about the layout of the building, the operations of the staff, and how the alarm system worked. He provided details of how the alarm could be bypassed, and also gave over key details of the vault room and how it had two security doors to access it. The first door, Werner said, needed to be unlocked simultaneously with two keys, which then led to an anteroom where there was a second door. The first door needed to be locked again before attempting to open the second door, or else the silent alarm would be triggered. Manri liked what he heard and relayed the detailed information back to Burke. Werner estimated that the score from the job would be around $2 million. Burke agreed that they had a great plan, but before they can move forward, he needed approval from those higher up in the organized crime ladder. You see, Jimmy Burke was on a much higher level than Martin Krugman within the Mafiosa organization, and he knew a lot of powerful people who trusted him to be a competent and ruthless gangster. But Burke was not a made man in the Mafia. To be a made man, you would need to be of full Italian heritage, meaning that both sides of your parents' families could be traced back to being from Italy, the old country, before coming to America. Burke, however, was just an associate. He could never rise any higher in the Mafia because he was of Irish descent. At least, at this time, that was the case. In September 2000, the five crime families of New York actually changed this ruling so that you could be made if your father was of Italian heritage and if you had an Italian surname. but I digress. Burke's reputation did give him direct access to a capo regime in the Lucchese crime family, however, a capo by the name of Paul Vario. Vario was interpreted as the character of Paul Cicero in the movie Goodfellas and was played by Paul Sorvino, a brilliant character actor who often played organized crime figures. In the movie, Cicero was a no-nonsense father figure who was in charge of the overall crime outfit. Vario in reality was a capo, so a lieutenant in the crime family, who was two levels lower than the overall family boss, or godfather. The mafia don't actually use this term godfather, but it makes for effective understanding here. Vario still controlled a lot, however, and had a small army of men that ran his criminal exploits for him. Vario was extremely volatile and had a quick temper. On one specific occasion, Vario took his wife Phyllis out to dinner. While they were sat at the table, the waiter who served them accidentally spilled wine on Phyllis' dress, then tried to apologize and dry it with a cloth. An enraged Vario punched the waiter twice, breaking his nose. Vario then also sent two carloads of men with pipes and baseball bats to assault the waiter again after the restaurant had closed later that night. John F. Kennedy Airport was in Paul Vario's territory, so if the heist was to go down, it would need Vario's approval along with a piece of the score as tribute. Vario was open to the idea, but he wanted to confer with the other crime families who also operated in the same area. It was a respect thing, but more so, in the aftermath of a heist of this size, it was inevitable that the heat of law enforcement would be turned up in the area significantly, so the other family's businesses would likely be affected too. Bonanno crime family captain Vincent Asaro quickly gave his approval, while newly promoted Gambino family captain John Gotti was also happy to consent. It was also agreed that any vehicles used in the robbery could be taken to a John Gotti-owned junkyard in New Jersey to be crushed and thus destroy any evidence. Jimmy Burke was given the green light to move forward with the heist. Of the estimated $2 million that would be stolen, the Gambino family would receive $200,000, or 10% of the haul. Burke would also kick back tribute money to Paul Vario, the Bonanno family, and Martin Krugman for his referral fee. Lewis Werner, it was agreed, would also receive 10% of the take. This meant that half of the score would be provided to parties and associates, while Burke's own crew would pocket $50,000 each. In the end, Burke expected to make around $750,000 from the job, pure profit, and of course, not taxed. Burke already had a crew in place that he trusted and regularly worked with, so the manpower was no issue. There was only one thing holding them up. Burke didn't want to rob the terminal if the cash inside was low. They wanted to ensure that it was flush, so that the reward would outweigh the risk. Manry reached out to Werner again, and he was instructed to inform them when there would be a lot of cash in the vault. Well, November came and went without any contact from Werner. The crew began to get restless and to doubt that this job would actually happen. Then, on the afternoon of Friday, December the 8th, a large shipment of cash arrived at the airport from Germany. The Brink security truck drivers came to collect the money, but Werner refused to release it unless his boss signed the approval forms. This made it appear that Werner was being extra security conscious and playing the rules by the book. In actual fact, Werner knew that his boss had already left for the weekend and wouldn't be back. This meant the money would have to remain in the airport vault over the weekend. The security drivers dutifully waited around for around an hour to see if the signatures could be obtained, but ultimately their supervisor called them and told them to forget about it and return for the cash the following Monday. Werner's last-minute plan had worked. After Werner left work that day, he reached out to Manry immediately from a payphone to tell him that now was the perfect time. Werner was anxious and jittery. All he could do was wait. Everything was now out of his hands. Werner awoke on the Saturday morning of December 9th, expecting to hear about the heist on the news. But there weren't any reports. He didn't receive any phone calls either, either from Manry or his employer to tell them that a robbery had occurred. But that's because no robbery took place that Friday night. But when he woke up Sunday morning, nothing had happened that night either. Werner was tense, nervous. What the hell was happening, he thought. But he knew better than to reach out to anyone. Werner couldn't reach out to Manry and probe for information for fear that might scare the crew off at best, or at worst, it might make the crew think that the heist was a setup from law enforcement and that Werner was an informant. So all Werner could do was sit tight. When Monday morning arrived, Werner's life changed in ways that he could not imagine. At about 3 a.m., a black Ford Econoline van pulled up to the cargo terminal's gate. Meanwhile, a second car parked nearby. This car was being driven by Frank Burke, Jimmy's son. People who knew Frank Burke describe him, much like his father, as being a complete psychopath. But he had less charm than his dear old dad. Frank Burke's job that night was to sit tight and function as a crash car. Or in other words, if any police turned up and attempted to pursue the van after the heist, Frank was to crash into them to end the chase. Inside the Econoline van were five men. Firstly, Tommy DeSimone. DeSimone was another highly violent member of the crew, performing the heist and who would be portrayed by the Joe Pesci character of Tommy DeVito in Goodfellas. Whilst Henry Hill is quoted as saying that Joe Pesci portrayed a version of DeSimone entirely accurately, DeSimone was actually much larger in stature than Pesci. Pesci's volatility and flip-on-a-dime persona entirely reflected DeSimone, however. In addition to DeSimone, there was also Angelo Seppi, a Lucchese family associate with a reputation for violence. Joe Manry, the man who planned the heist with Louis Werner. Louis Cafora, a man who weighed about 300 pounds but was an experienced and expert stick-up man. And finally, there was Robert Frenchy McMahon, who was both friends and roommates with Manry. The two men lived together so that they could keep their expenses low, but also because they both knew that by pursuing a career in crime, it meant that there were not many other people that they could realistically live openly with. There could possibly have been an additional man on the crew named Paolo Lacastri. Lacastri was an Italian gangster who was affiliated with the Gambino crime family. It's alleged that the Gambinos insisted on Lacastri being part of the heist in order to receive their approval. John Gotti wanted to have presentation on the crew, and Lacastri was his man. Though I will add that as none of the crew would ever be questioned or tell their story, this crew member cannot be 100% confirmed. Once the van went through the gate and parked outside of the terminal, Manry, Frenchy, and Cafora went inside. DeSimone and Seppi acted as lookouts and waited in the van. The reason why the crew went in at the specific time of 3 a.m. was because they knew the overnight terminal crew all took their assigned lunch hour at this time. According to Werner, there were 10 people working that night who needed to be subdued as the crew entered the building. The security guard was away from his desk. No one knew they were there. The first employee the crew encountered was John Murray, a senior cargo agent that was trying to catch a quick nap at his desk. He was abruptly awakened and marched into the cafeteria where five other employees were eating and relaxing. John Murray was then ordered to tell the gunman who else was in the building. He answered that Carrie Whelan, a transfer man, Rudy Elrich, the night shift manager, Rolf Reberman, and a newly employed security guard were somewhere inside. Murray was then marched back into his office and a gun was pointed to his head. He was ordered to get Rudy Ulrich out of his office by telling him there was an important phone call from Frankfurt that he needed to take. Ulrich indeed stepped out and he was quickly captured without incident. The crew now had 7 out of the 10 employees, but they were still missing the other 3. They frantically searched the warehouse for the missing men, but could not find them anywhere. Meanwhile, both Seppi and DeSimone were waiting inside the van and had no idea what was happening in the facility. At least one of the men removed their ski masks because it was getting hot. Suddenly, another van pulled into the parking lot and it made Seppi and DeSimone both very nervous. It was driven by Lufthansa employee Kerry Whelan, who who had just returned from a delivery. Whelan saw the black van but assumed it was just a driver from another airline. The two men in the van didn't like this though, and they perhaps overzealously leapt out. Whelan was quickly captured, but the struggle made enough noise that it captured the attention of another unaccounted employee by the name of Ralph Redman. Both men were pulled into the van and threatened with death if they tried anything and didn't listen to the instructions that they would be given. As the crew searched the Lufthansa building with Elrich in tow as hostage, they found the missing security guard that they were looking for. His name was Samuel Veltri. Veltri, it seems, was busy going over his security instruction list as everything had been going down. Ironically, due to this, he was completely unaware that a robbery was in progress. Meanwhile, back inside the van, the two armed men were getting more nervous. One of them went to the building to see what was going on. Through the door, he saw one of his fellow crew members searching the building. They spoke and learned about the two hostages in the van. Everyone was now accounted for. The cargo bay doors of the terminal were opened, and the van drove in. Whelan and Redman were pulled out of the vehicle and marched inside to join the rest of the Lufthansa employees being held in the cafeteria. At some point, some of the hostages thought it was smart to show resistance to the crew, and they were pistol-whipped for their trouble. Luckily, no one was killed. With everyone now secured, the gunman singled out Elrich and took him into the vault. They revealed the knowledge which they had obtained about the alarm system doors and warned Elrich that they had people at his house and that his family were also being held hostage. If Elrich tried to engage the alarm or was to try anything smart, then his family would be killed, he was warned. Elrich had no choice but to open the vault doors as instructed. The crew now had access to what they came for. 72 individual 15-pound cartons of untraceable cash and jewellery. It was all hurriedly removed from the vault and put into the van. Nothing was left behind. Once this was done, Elrich was taken to the cafeteria. It is believed it was Louis Cafora who was guarding the employees. Cafora, as he had a very unique physical description due to his weight. So we know from hostage reports that he was the individual executing this element of the plan. During this time, Cafora took a quarter from one of the employees being held at gunpoint so that he could buy a soda from the cafeteria vending machine. A fairly humorous action when you think about it. Most employees were handcuffed behind their back, but John Murray's hands were bound with rope and Elrich was secured with plastic tape. It's not clear why the Lufthansa heist crew did not bring enough handcuffs with them for all of the hostages, especially given how they knew specifically that there would be 10 employees working that night. The staff were all warned not to move for another 10 minutes. During the planning of the heist, Werner warned Manry that it would take the Port Authority around 90 seconds to respond to the alarm, so the crew now needed to act very quickly. Two gunmen got into the van, which was now also packed with more money and jewellery than they had anticipated, while the rest of the team had to jump in the waiting crash car with Frank Burke. Both vehicles drove away from the airport without any trouble or incident, and they casually disappeared into the night. Of the hostages left behind, John Murray was the first that managed to free himself, and he instantly called the police. The heat was now on. But what none of the robbery crew knew was that they had more to worry about from the man who had organized the robbery than they did from the police. Jimmy Burke was only just getting started. The van and the Buick being driven by Frank Burke arrived at an auto repair shop in the Canarsie area of Brooklyn, a neighborhood on Brooklyn's Far East Side. Jimmy Burke and Stax Edwards were awaiting them when they arrived. Stax was an African-American low-level hoodlum who aspired to be a blues singer while he worked odd jobs for Jimmy to make ends meet. You'll recall that Stax Edwards was played by a young Samuel L. Jackson in Scorsese's picture. The two vehicles drove in and the garage door closed to provide them with privacy. The 72 boxes from the van were removed and placed into the trunk of the Buick and another car which was driven by Burke. Jimmy and his son Frank drove in one car while Tommy DeSimone, Seppi, Frenchie and Manry left in the other. Stax took the van and was ordered to take it to John Gotti's junkyard in New Jersey to be destroyed, while Louis Scafora decided to walk a few blocks and be picked up by his wife. Paolo Lacastri, if he indeed was involved in the heist, most likely took the subway home, it's alleged. One thing for sure is that everyone walked away that night in high spirits and in a really good mood. Now, every piece of physical paper currency printed by the United States Treasury has a serial number assigned and printed on it. Usually, when large amounts of cash are being physically transferred, all of the bills come from the same printing batch and thus have consecutive serial numbers. These numbers get recorded, and when stolen cash re-enters the banking system, it gets flagged and the government can track and locate where the cash came from, and ultimately pinpoint where the thieves are spending the stolen funds. It has allowed the government and FBI to track hundreds of stolen funds over the years. But this situation was entirely different, and different in a way that benefited the heist crew massively. You see, the money at the Lufthansa cargo terminal came from foreign currency exchanges in Germany. The physical cash came from all over America and was exchanged by hundreds of different travelers making numerous individual cash exchanges for German currency. That means the serial numbers were not sequential and entirely useless to government tracking. Further, none of the serial numbers had even been logged anyway, further blocking any chance of a tracking operation being successful. The FBI were looking for a needle in a haystack, essentially, as the stolen cash was entirely untraceable. After the Port Authority had secured the terminal, the FBI, the Queens District Attorney agents, and New York PD detectives all arrived at the scene. By the time the sun rose that morning, four agencies were actively on the hunt for the heist crew, and they already had two separate leads. Rolf Redman, the employee, was taken outside of the building and held in the van, told authorities that it was a black Ford Econoline. Rudy Elrich told investigators that the thieves knew in detail how the alarm for the vault operated, which meant that someone working on the inside gave them that information. The van lead should have been a dead end because it was supposed to have been disposed of at John Gotti's junkyard, but for some unknown reason, Stax Edwards did not do his job, choosing instead to get high and go in the search for female company. He parked the van illegally on the street and just left it there without a care in the world. It was recovered by the police just 2 days after the heist, and it didn't take the investigators long to connect it to the robbery. They even managed to pull fingerprints from the van. Such a schoolboy error. Stax Edwards, with all his sloppiness, sadly signed his own death warrant. No matter how likable Stax was to those that knew him, his actions following the heist could get everyone involved in the heist traced by law enforcement, including Jimmy Burke. The damage he caused needed to be contained. Stax hid out in an apartment in Ozone Park, Queens, hoping to avoid both law enforcement and the heist crew. He knew he had messed up. On December the 18th, just 1 week after the robbery, his friends Tommy DeSimone paid Stax a visit along with Angelo Seppi. The two men were welcomed by Stax into his apartment, where small talk occurred before DeSimone fired 6 bullets into the back of Stax's head. DeSimone guaranteed Stax's silence. Meanwhile, Louis Werner was largely uninvolved with the heist except for his connections to Joe Manry and Martin Krugman. But as investigators pursued their theory that this was an inside job, Werner was their prime suspect, mainly due to the $22,000 worth of foreign currency that had disappeared 2 years prior. Werner kept his mouth shut though. He could be a tough cookie when he wanted to be. He knew that the people who carried out this heist were dangerous, and if he cracked, then he would be dead with no hesitation. He knew that his life meant nothing to the heist crew. Besides, he knew he was due a substantial payout once all the heat had died down. Although Werner was the prime suspect, every single employee was looked at closely. Even Peter Grunewald came under suspicion. Werner was given a small cut of the robbery to hold him over for now, and he gave a portion of that money to Grunewald in order to buy his silence. In the initial weeks of the investigation, both men remained silent, but that did not clear them of any suspicion in law enforcement's view. It likely didn't help that Werner bought a new car and Grunewald paid off all of his debts during this time either. From the point of view of investigators, out of all the employees that could be the inside man or men, these two were the safest bets. It didn't take long before Stack's fingerprints were identified from those taken from the van. When police found his dead body with the 6 holes in his head, they knew they had discovered another link to the robbery. Stax had been killed execution style, so detectives knew they weren't dealing with an amateur crew. Evidence was slowly building up. Detectives very quickly pieced together that Stax Edwards was a regular at Robert's Lounge, which was owned by Jimmy Burke, a well-known career criminal and hijacker very familiar to law enforcement. Burke was a man who spent more days in prison than he did outside in his youth. James Burke was now suspect number one for being the overall mastermind of the Lufthansa heist, but Burke was determined to get away with it, even if that meant destroying his entire crew. It's highly likely that Jimmy Burke had no idea who Peter Grunewald was. But Lewis Werner, on the other hand, was a loose end for him, one that needed to be tied up in Burke's view. The only saving grace for Werner at this point was that Burke assumed that Werner was being closely watched by law enforcement, so Burke took the view to lay off him for the time being. Besides, Werner was essentially keeping his mouth shut and playing dumb about the heist, while patiently waiting for his cut once the heat cooled down. Burke couldn't ask for a better silent partner. The same cannot be said, however, for Martin Krugman. Krugman was not a suspect in law enforcement's sights, and was thus off the radar. But he wanted his 10% finder's fee, which had ballooned from the originally estimated $200,000 to now more than $500,000 after the haul turned out to be significantly higher than the planners had anticipated. It's well known that Burke did not like Krugman at all. He hated the man. According to Henry Hill, the thought of giving that much money to a scumbag like Krugman did not sit right with Jimmy Burke, whether he was owed it or not. It made Burke feel sick to even consider giving that much cash to someone like Krugman, and someone who had essentially just passed contact information from one person to another. Krugman had not planned anything, had not taken part in the heist. He was almost entirely uninvolved in the robbery in any way, and there was no way Burke was going to give him $500,000 for doing nothing. Jimmy Burke rationalized to himself that Martin Krugman should be murdered on principle. In Burke's head, this was the right action to take. Krugman made things easier, of course, by being a whiny, moaning ballbuster. On the Tuesday night, the day after the robbery, Burke ordered Henry Hill to bring Krugman to the Riviera Motel under the guise that they were meeting some prostitutes, as you do. Once there, Tommy DeSimone and Angelo Seppi were to kill Krugman. Henry Hill and his wife Karen were friends with Krugman and his wife, though, and Hill was extremely uneasy over the entire thing. Henry didn't feel comfortable setting up his friend, and he tried to delay and talk Jimmy out of committing the murder. Somehow, his pleas appear to have worked, mainly because Burke was in such a good mood that night. Hill had already made plans with Krugman to go out that night, so they both went to a bar and got drunk over cocktails. While drunk, Krugman revealed to Hill what his cut from the heist was supposed to be. Following this, everything made sense to Hill about Burke's motivations, and Hill knew that sooner or later, Krugman would be a dead man. When Stax Edwards' corpse turned up a few days later, Krugman, perhaps naively, believed that he was the victim of a drug deal gone bad. Krugman remained blissfully unaware of the huge danger that he was in. But Krugman continued to nag, demand, whine and whinge at Burke for his cut of the money. Foolishly so, knowing Burke's reputation. Krugman's excuse for being so pushy was that the inside man was demanding his cut and he was just the messenger. So Burke gave Krugman $50,000 to keep him quiet for now. Krugman in turn passed $40,000 to Lewis Werner, said Henry Hill. Krugman, of course, deducting the money he was owed from Werner's gambling debt first. Christmas and New Year passed quietly. As 1979 rolled in, Krugman continued to pester Burke about his share, and even started to believe that Stax Edwards' death was connected to the heist and not, in fact, a drug deal after all. But Krugman had a big mouth. He lacked the ability to keep the Stax theory to himself. Krugman quickly went from being annoying to Jimmy Burke to becoming a significant liability. Krugman couldn't help but shout his mouth and opinions about, comments that all found their way back to Burke. On the morning of January 6, 1979, Krugman's wife Fran called the Hills house to tell them that Martin had not returned home the night before. Fran asked Henry to go out in search for her missing husband. According to the book Wise Guy, Hill said, quote, "I drove over to Vinnie Asaro's fence company and I saw Jimmy Burke's car parked outside. I walked in and I said that Fran had just called me. Jimmy was sitting there and Vinnie was sitting next to him. Jimmy said, 'He's gone.' Just like that. I looked at him and shook my head. But he just said, 'Go pick up your wife and go over there. Tell her that he's probably with a girlfriend. You know, give her a story.'" Unquote. Krugman's body was never found. His estimated date of death is January the 4th, 1979. He was legally declared dead in 1986. The Lufthansa heist has become more notorious in popular culture because of its aftermath rather than the actual heist itself. This is due to the strange and untimely deaths of all those involved. Well, almost all. The majority of the crew members' deaths were committed by Jimmy Burke himself in order to sever any ties between the crime and himself in the eyes of law enforcement. There were also some members of the crew who were murdered for unrelated reasons at around the same time on a sort of twisted coincidence. Tommy DeSimone was one of those who died for reasons unrelated to the heist. He was, after Krugman, the next one to die. DeSimone was married and acted like a family man for the most part, when he was not being a gangster, of course. He led a double life. Make no mistake, DeSimone was a violent psychopath who actually enjoyed killing people. The scene in the movie Goodfellas, where the Joe Pesci character, who is an interpretation of DeSimone, murders the teenager named Spider because he stood up for himself, actually really did happen. DeSimone could turn from a friendly, charming guy to an enraged and violent killer in a split second. Also like in the movie, the murder of Gambino family soldier Billy Batts by DeSimone and Burke also took place in real life. In the movie, Tommy returns to the bar the same night to kill Batts after Batts insulted him. But the true events happened in a slightly different way. DeSimone patiently waited 2 weeks for the man to let his guard down, and then he attacked like a wild and cold-blooded predator. While Tommy DeSimone might have been a genuine friend of Jimmy Burke and a member of his crew, there was one person who did not like him, and that was Lucchese capo Paul Vario. Ultimately, there are two types of men in a mafia family. Those who are smart and know how to generate money, always hustling, always planning the next job. And the other kind are those who can use brutal violence to enforce operations and people, ensuring that they keep in line and do so without any care in the world. Tommy DeSimone was absolutely the second type. He wasn't very smart, but he was ruthless and physically powerful. Some, however, felt that DeSimone was way too wild and difficult to control. To become a made member of a family, you needed to have the ability to kill someone, sure. But guys like DeSimone were loose cannons, which made them bigger liabilities than assets to the business-oriented leadership higher up the ladder, like Vario. Regardless of how various people felt about DeSimone, word got out just after Christmas 1978 that Tommy DeSimone was to become a made member of the Lucchese crime family. To an Italian gangster, this would be huge news. DeSimone would have been overjoyed about how things had worked out for him. The future was looking incredibly positive, he no doubt thought. With this position came great power and respect. DeSimone had just made a ton of money from the robbery, and now he was about to become an official member of the Mafia. He couldn't believe his luck. Just after Burke had Martin Krugman killed, him and Henry Hill headed by road to Florida so they could chase down a professional scam artist who had cheated Burke out of $250,000 from a bogus cocaine deal. While Burke and Hill were traveling, Burke made a phone call to see how Tommy's induction ceremony had gone. When Burke returned to the car, there were tears in his eyes, Hill said. Burke told Hill that the ceremony was a setup and Tommy had been executed. The execution was carried out by John Gotti as payback for killing Billy Batts and another Gambino family associate named Foxy Girothe. Tommy had killed both men without permission and also had sex with Foxy's sister as a further display of disrespect. Tommy was shot in the face, which Gotti intended as a sign of returned disrespect. DeSimone's mother was now unable to allow her son to have an open casket at her son's funeral. This was by design. By Cosa Nostra standards, DeSimone broke some of the strictest rules, a breach which in turn demanded a death sentence. On January the 14th, 1979, Cookie DeSimone, Tommy's wife, reported her husband missing to the police. Side note, I always find it quite contradictory, if not slightly humorous, that members of the Mafia have strict codes of conduct, never rat on their friends or associates, never pay taxes or take part in structured society, never cooperate with law enforcement, and almost everything they do to earn money is illegal in some way, shape or form. Yet when someone disappears, they call the police. Anyway, the first month of the new year was not even halfway over, and now two men connected to the largest heist in American history had been murdered. As the year progressed, the body count would continue to rise. As people began to disappear and pass away unexpectedly, law enforcement continued to aggressively push on with their investigation. In their minds, there was now no doubt that the robbery had been carried out by Jimmy Burke and his crew. They still couldn't prove it, however. There was plenty of hearsay from informants and rumors from the streets that the Roberts Lounge crew was behind the heist. But law enforcement needed hard evidence if they were to convict. Investigators now decided to zero in on four suspects in particular. Those suspects were Tommy DeSimone, Angelo Seppi, Frank Burke, and a man named Anthony Rodriguez. Now, Rodriguez in particular stands out on this list. He was a known criminal, sure, but his name in the story only comes up in regards to the list of suspects that the FBI were looking at. No one is quite clear why Rodriguez was added to the list, although I'm sure law enforcement saw sense in their decision at the time. But Rodriguez had no association with Burke or his crew, he wasn't affiliated with the Mafia, and he had no links to the Lufthansa Airlines. Whilst the investigators were entirely wrong about Rodriguez, they were entirely right to be looking at DeSimone and Seppi. The FBI believed that they were the two gunmen who stayed behind with the van during the first phase of the robbery when they captured Kerry Whalen. As I previously mentioned, during that time, they became hot and removed their ski masks, allowing Whalen an opportunity to get a look at their faces. Whalen would later pick out Seppi's mugshot when being interviewed by the FBI. DeSimone had also removed his mask at some point during the robbery and allowed his face to be seen. Like Seppi, another witness identified DeSimone from his mugshot, but he would never be brought in for questioning. Authorities assumed that DeSimone went on the run following the heist and from the heat that it was bringing. Law enforcement were completely unaware that DeSimone was already dead following the Mafia hit. The assistant United States attorney for the Eastern District, Edward A. McDonald, became the lead investigator for the case. He initiated increased surveillance of Burke and his crew. The surveillance would quickly turn into a cat and mouse game between the cops and robbers, with the crew becoming experts at slipping their government tails and disappearing for days on end, sometimes even leaving the state whilst law enforcement were none the wiser. Jimmy Burke was out of prison and on parole at the time, and McDonald could have thrown him back behind bars for a number of violations, but that wasn't going to help recover the money, so McDonald chose to let them roam free and see where it might lead. On February the 7th, 1979, McDonald decided to turn up the heat when he subpoenaed 10 people to appear in front of a grand jury, some of which were known Lucchese family members. McDonald announced to the press that Stax Edwards was believed to have been murdered by the missing Tommy DeSimone, and both men were connected to the Lufthansa heist. Next, the police made their move against Angelo Seppi. Witnesses had reported seeing Seppi armed at the time of the robbery, which was a direct violation of his parole. Law enforcement arrested Seppi on February the 17th and searched his home, hoping to find evidence connecting him to the heist. At a stretch, the police thought that they might get lucky and find some of the stolen money itself, though they didn't hold their breath on that one. During the search, all they found was Jimmy Burke relaxing inside. Seppi was charged with participating in the robbery, but he claimed to have had an alibi for the night in question. The only connection that law enforcement had linking Seppi was Whalen picking out his mugshot. It wasn't much for police to go on. Seppi and Burke refused to talk, however, and by late March, the charges against Seppi were dropped, minus his parole violation, of course. In April 1979, Burke was finally arrested for violating his parole, in particular for associating with a known felon. These would be the most charges that either man would face in relation to the robbery, however. All leads to the Roberts Lounge crew were turning into dead ends thanks to disappearing suspects and a wall of silence. McDonald's only hope for this case was the two Lufthansa employees that he believed were involved in the heist in some way. Law enforcement knew that Lewis Werner and Peter Grunewald came into large amounts of cash following the robbery, but both men claimed that these were the rewards of gambling. Neither Werner or Grunewald would change their story, and this appeared to be a dead end as well. But law enforcement soon had a break. Grunewald was summoned to appear in front of a grand jury, but before that was scheduled to happen, he had already planned to vacation outside of the country to South Asia. As he tried to board his plane, he was unaware that due to his summons, he could not leave the country. He was picked up at the terminal and subsequently arrested. McDonald personally met with Grunewald to try and get him to change his story, but he refused to be persuaded. They transferred him to the Nassau County Jail and placed him in the general population so he could ponder what his future had in store. After a week, he decided the prison was not for him, and it certainly wasn't worth his tiny cut from the heist, so Grunewald decided to start talking. In addition to what he knew about the 1978 heist, he also told them about the time in 1976 when his friend, Lewis Werner, stole a cardboard box full of money from the Lufthansa vault. After Grunewald told investigators everything he knew, they then went after Frank Manner. Remember Frank? The bookie gopher who took the heist idea to Marty Krugman. When Manner opened his front door and saw the FBI agent standing there, the first words out of his mouth were, quote, "I want immunity." Authorities also went after William Fraschetti, the boyfriend of Lewis Werner's estranged wife. You'll recall, he was the man who laundered the money when it was originally stolen in 76. Fraschetti folded under questioning pretty much instantly. He was more concerned about his wife finding out about his affair with Werner's wife, Beverly, than anything else. So who did the FBI question next? That's right, Beverly Werner and Werner's current girlfriend, Janet Barbieri. Both women broke down under questioning right away. They both admitted that Werner had boasted about his role in the heist. So much for loyalty, eh? Edward McDonald couldn't use Beverly's testimony against Werner as she was his wife. Although estranged, but the way the McDonalds saw it, Janet Barbieri was fair game. While Frank Manner's connection was between Werner and Marty Krugman, who was already dead, any link to Jimmy Burke was essentially broken. But with three witnesses willing to testify against Lewis Werner, Ed McDonald decided that he had enough evidence to go after the Lufthansa heist's inside man. On February the 20th, Lewis Werner was arrested outside of a bowling alley, just as he was trying to get into his brand new van that he had just purchased with the stolen cash. With this, Jimmy Burke felt the noose of law enforcement tightening around his neck, and he was determined not to go to prison for this, whilst also trying to keep the millions that he had stolen. On February the 18th, 1979, a group of children playing in a part of Brooklyn named The Pit opened an abandoned tractor trailer and discovered a dead human body inside that was frozen solid. The police were called, and detectives James Shea and Robert Kohler were assigned to the case. A small address book was found hidden inside the man's clothing. It was covertly sewed between fabric layers and was seemingly unknown to his murderers. There was one contact inside the book that piqued the detective's interest right away. James Burke. By now, all of law enforcement believed that Burke was the number one suspect in the Lufthansa heist. So they assumed that he had killed this unknown man too, also assuming that he was connected to the robbery. They were half right with their guesses. After 3 days, once the body had thawed, the police examined the body's teeth and matched them to dental records. This would identify the man as Richard Eaton, a professional scam artist. Now in January of that year, you'll recall that Jimmy Burke and Henry Hill had taken a trip to Florida. It was the same trip where Burke had learned about Tommy DeSimone being executed. You may also recall that the reason that Burke and Hill were in Florida was because they were chasing Eaton. He had stolen money from Burke during a fake drug deal, and Burke, of course, wanted revenge. Well, Burke and Hill had been unsuccessful in locating Eaton whilst in Florida, something that differs massively from the movie Goodfellas. Their paths would cross with him at a later date, however. Eaton made the mistake of visiting New York a few months later, and that's when they got him. Another heist death that turned out to be unconnected was the disappearance of Teresa Ferreira. Ferreira was a beauty shop owner who moonlighted as a drug dealer at night. She was rumored to have become a police informant, and on February the 10th, she received a phone call at work, telling her staff that she was popping out for a meeting but would be back in 15 minutes. No one ever saw Teresa again. Eventually, her dismembered torso washed up in New Jersey a few months later. She could only be identified by the serial numbers on her breast implants. Ferreira was a regular at Robert's Lounge, and Henry Hill claimed that she was killed because she was supposed to launder money for Paul Vario, but instead tried to steal it. Kind of a dumb move, really. Police dismiss Hill's claims, though, and they believe she was killed because she cooperated with the police in a huge 1978 drug bust. But I guess we'll never know for sure. What we do know, though, is that she played no part in the Lufthansa heist. Jimmy Burke started to look at his crew with suspicious eyes. He began trying to ascertain who might be the weakest link or links. In Burke's view, Angelo Seppi was a stand-up guy that did prison time. He also committed murder when ordered. So he was safe for now. Robert Frenchy McMahon and Joe Buddha Manry also seemed to be dependable guys with a hardcore dedication to the lifestyle. Manry might be a potential problem later, as he was the only contact between Werner and the crew, Burke thought, but Burke was willing to let that play out for now, as the man seemed loyal. So Jimmy Burke decided that the weakest link was Louis Cofora, and the reason wasn't that a witness could easily identify his extremely overweight body frame, although there was that. The problem was more so his wife, Joanna. This was Cofora's second marriage, and he was head over heels in love with Joanna. She was a regular at Robert's Lounge, always attending with Cofora after they got married back in 78. Joanna was incredibly close to her husband, and sometimes she would be within distance as to overhear his conversations. This made Cofora's fellow gangsters uncomfortable and slightly nervous, because while wives may have had an idea of what their husbands did, they were never supposed to be involved or informed. What made Burke even more annoyed with Cofora was that on the night of the heist, his wife drove out to pick him up. She absolutely knew more than she was supposed to, and that made her a liability, along with her careless husband, Burke surmised. The FBI also zeroed in on the couple, and they were both even brought into the 113th precinct for questioning, although both stayed firm in their denials of knowledge and were ultimately released. However, police later claimed that Cofora had a change of heart and agreed to meet with them to tell them everything. But he never showed up to that meeting. He and Joanna mysteriously disappeared sometime in March of that year, and it is presumed that Jimmy Burke was responsible in some way. The government, at the start of May, was fast-tracking the trial against Lewis Werner so that it could bring down pressure on Burke and his crew. Burke knew that he was under the microscope, so all he could do at that time was wait. And wait he did, although Jimmy Burke was not out yet and still had a few moves left to play. After people connected to the heist began to disappear in oh-so-strange circumstances, the Assistant Attorney General, Edward MacDonald, knew right away that he had only one move left to play, and that move was Lewis Werner. Werner was charged for his involvement in the robbery. Police referred to him openly as the inside man, and his bail was set at $1 million, of which half needed to be paid in cash. Werner didn't have that much money, and even if he did receive his 10% cut from the heist and use it for bail, he would still have needed to explain where the money came from, bearing in mind his low average salary for the time, no savings and gambling debts which the FBI were completely aware of. The bail amount and restrictions were almost certainly a game plan from law enforcement. Werner knew he was in a corner, so he was forced to languish in jail and await things to play out in the hope that Lady Justice leaned in his favour. Not the best set of options, but it's all he had. Just a few days later, a grand jury formally indicted Werner based on the evidence available. For anyone looking at this case from a point of neutrality, Werner seemed to be guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This is almost entirely thanks to Peter Grunewald and Frank Manner both turning against their friend. Werner's girlfriend, Janet Barbieri, also appeared to have turned her back on him as well. Werner was pretty alienated. But Werner still refused to cooperate, implicate anyone, or accept any guilt. Honestly, the mafia got lucky with this guy's integrity towards them. Ed MacDonald next charts where the money stolen in 1976 had gone, which Peter Grunewald and William Forchetti could testify about with the added bonus of being of who laundered the money. But still, Werner remained silent. Whether that was out of hope that if he rode the waves he would still get his $500,000, or maybe he was just afraid of the men who actually carried out the robbery. Probably a little of both. Werner's trial went about as well as anyone could possibly want, at least from the law enforcement's view. Multiple witnesses testified against him about his gambling problem, his prior theft of the 1976 money, and his planning and robbing the cargo terminal once again in 1978. The only moment of surprise in the trial was when Janet Barbieri was due to testify against Werner. She changed her mind at the 11th hour and backed out. She claimed that she loved the man too much to be able to testify against him. The FBI wouldn't let her back out of her earlier statements, though, and held her to them. Ultimately, Barbieri pretended that she was unwell, saying that she had a heart condition, and if she took to the stand, she could die from the stress. The judge called bullshit and didn't believe a word, however. He had her arrested for contempt of court. On May the 11th, US Marshals marched Barbieri in, and she changed her story while on the stand. She claimed that Werner never spoke to her about the heist. She cried and trembled the whole time that she testified. Just to add a pinch more drama to the proceedings, she also collapsed three times while delivering her testimony and was moved to a private area. She should have won an Oscar for her performance, in all honesty, but sadly the Academy did not recognize her that year. Barbieri's testimony, though, would be cut short when a doctor monitoring her said that her blood pressure and pulse were actually rising to high and unsafe levels. The judge subsequently dismissed and released her. On May 14th, the prosecution rested its case. The defense decided not to call any witnesses of its own. On the following afternoon, the jury began its deliberations. Within less than 24 hours, on May the 16th, the jury announced that Lewis Werner was found guilty of three of the six charges laid against him. He faced a potential sentence of up to 25 years in federal prison. Jimmy Burke was following the trial closely, as it wouldn't take much to implicate him and draw him into the proceedings. But Werner kept his mouth shut during it. But if he was sentenced to the maximum term, then there was a good chance that he might talk, it was thought. Well, Joe Manry and Frenchy McMahon may have been good guys, but they too could also flip when staring at that kind of time. plus Manry was the only link between Burke and Werner, which made them a double threat. Later that evening, several hours after the guilty verdict was delivered, McMahon and Manry were found dead in a parked car in Brooklyn. Both had been shot in the back of their heads, and it was clear to the authorities that they knew who their killer was, and likely considered them a friend. Manry was suspected as being part of the heist at the time because of his connection to Burke, while McMahon was not on law enforcement's radar just yet. Werner remained in custody and awaited his sentencing on June 26th. The government brought the convicted, but not yet sentenced, inside man in front of a grand jury to give him one more chance to cooperate before appearing at the mercy of the judge. Werner refused. 3 days later, on the 29th of June, Lewis Werner was sentenced to 15 years in prison plus a $25,000 fine. He was 46 years old at the time of the sentence, and he continued to profess his innocence as he was taken to prison. Also in June, Paolo Lacastri, the man who may or may not have been part of the robbery crew allegedly representing the Gambino crime family, was found dead on Flatlands Avenue in Brooklyn. His death was caused by 4 bullet holes in his head. He was shirtless and shoeless, and in an area that newspapers described as a place for dumping trash, unwanted things, and waste. As July 1979 approached, it was now more than 6 months from when the Lufthansa heist was carried out. And irrespective of if it was a 5 or 6 person crew that carried out the robbery, Angelo Seppi was still alive. Jimmy's son Frank, who drove the crash car that night, was also still above ground, though Jimmy was unlikely to whack his own son. By now, Jimmy aside, everyone else who was connected to the robbery, beyond Lewis Werner and his associates, had been taken care of. They were all gone. Likewise, Lewis Werner had zero contact with any of the remaining men, so there was no way he could definitely lead authorities to them. Burke's name wasn't even brought up at Werner's trial, not once. Instead, Martin Krugman was, but he was missing. Jimmy Burke might have finally felt that he could relax a little bit because he got away with this one. But law enforcement was not going to let the matter go so easily. US Attorney Ed McDonald and his multi-agency task force of investigators felt pretty confident after winning their trial against Louis Werner. One thing that gave him a lot of comfort was of the large amounts of money stolen, it would all need to be laundered in order for the perpetrators to actually use what they had acquired. And to successfully launder that amount of cash, you would need to bring in a lot of extra people to process it. While it was accepted that less than 10 people were involved in actually stealing the money, there would realistically need to be another 20 to 30 other people involved in moving the cash. So the feds knew that eventually, somewhere, the odds were good that someone would make a mistake. These weren't intelligent or highly skilled professionals, after all. But the second half of 1979 was full of dead ends for investigators. They investigated many murders they suspected of being connected to the heist, but would eventually rule them all out. They spoke to many witnesses who claimed to have information, but those all turned out to be bogus too. And the remaining men they believed to have been the perpetrators kept their mouths firmly shut and stayed away from the money. Even when the one-year anniversary of the heist came, in December, still no progress had been made since Werner's incarceration back in June. The case appeared to be turning cold. But 1980 would become a very bad year for Jimmy Burke. That April, Henry Hill, a close associate of Burke's, who was not involved in the heist, was arrested for dealing drugs. Hill was an addict at the time, which made his underworld associates afraid that he might cooperate with the FBI. Hill was initially against that idea, always vowed to never rat on his friends. But that was until federal agents shared some surveillance evidence that they had come across. The first piece of evidence was a wiretap where Angelo Seppi was heard trying to convince Jimmy Burke to kill Henry Hill. Seppi's justification for suggesting this was to guarantee Hill's silence. The next tape they played was Burke visiting Paul Vario. Burke requested Vario's permission to kill Henry Hill. so by this Henry knew that Burke had agreed with Seppi's viewpoint. Hill stayed quiet at first and was released on bail, but he quickly realized that the FBI was right. Burke was going to murder him. As he pondered his next move, McDonald arrested him as a material witness in the Lufthansa heist. Hill had three choices: let himself get murdered, go to prison for decades and likely get murdered in there anyway, or cooperate against the people that wanted to kill him and enter the witness protection program. Hill chose the third option. But investigators soon realized that Henry Hill was an extremely unreliable, drug-addicted, compulsive liar and criminal. It was difficult for them to get concrete and accurate information from him. And it wasn't because he was stonewalling or trying to protect someone, but because his mind was mush. It was all over the place. Steve Carbone, the FBI agent who debriefed him, claimed that Hill had the mentality of an 8-year-old kid. He also did not have any real knowledge about the Lufthansa heist because he was not part of it. All his knowledge was second-hand hearsay and useless in a courtroom. Hill's lack of involvement in the heist was of particular interest to investigators because he appeared to be close with Burke. You see, Burke wanted Hill involved in the Lufthansa heist, but couldn't because Hill had bad blood with Angelo Seppi. This was because Hill and Seppi served time together in prison. At the time, another inmate had roughed up Hill, and Hill hadn't defended himself. Due to this incident, Seppi called Hill a queer, and he no longer wanted anything to do with Henry. Investigators thought that they had caught a big fish when Henry Hill turned state's evidence, but they soon became disappointed in what that he could actually provide. However, since the taxpayers were now footing the bill for Hill's existence in the witness protection program, they needed to use him in any way they possibly could. Often that meant him appearing as a witness in low-level trials. But one day, Hill finally proved his worth entirely by accident. Prosecutors asked him to help convince a woman that was part of his drug dealing operation to cooperate with them. During their interview with her, she could not remember where she was on a particular date, which prompted Hill to remind her that they were together in Boston fixing basketball games. Hill was pressed further about the games, and law enforcement learned that Burke was part of a game-fixing scam with four other men. Jimmy Burke was arrested in 1980 and held without bail. His trial followed the next year in 1981, and he was found guilty. In January 1982, Jimmy Burke was sentenced to 20 years in federal prison. But if Ed McDonald hoped that the possibility of the 52-year-old spending the rest of his life behind bars would get him to trade something about the Lufthansa heist, he couldn't be more wrong. On February 6, 1984, Burke was indicted for the murder of Richard Eaton, the scam artist whose corpse was found by a group of children frozen in a trailer. Thanks to Henry Hill's testimony, Burke was found guilty and sentenced to spend the rest of his life behind bars. While the government might have gotten Burke off the streets, there were still huge amounts of stolen money out there that hadn't been recovered. The Lufthansa heist was still officially considered unsolved, with the exception of Lewis Werner's conviction. But sadly, at least for them, any remaining participants that were still on the streets were not going to live happily ever after. At the same time that Jimmy Burke was facing his own mortality and realizing that he would never be a free man again, things were evolving for the other heist group members on the outside. Angelo Seppi would not live to see 1985. On July the 18th, 1984, Seppi was found murdered along with his 19-year-old girlfriend, Joanne Lombardo. It was believed that a week before his death, he robbed a drug dealer with mob connections. Those connections then went to work when they entered Seppi's basement apartment in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Lombardo was killed as she slept with a single bullet to the head. Seppi received three gunshots to his own head. Later, Frank Burke, Jimmy's son, became an associate to the Gambino crime family. He was shot to death on May the 18th, 1987, by a convicted drug dealer on Liberty Avenue in the Cypress Hill neighborhood of Brooklyn. Because of Paul Vario's importance in the organized crime hierarchy, he is probably only one of the few people to get his cut from Jimmy Burke, along with the Bonanno and Gambino crime families. In 1984, Henry Hill testified against Paul Vario for providing him with a no-show job in the 1970s so that he could get out of prison on parole. Vario was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison and was later convicted again for extorting protection payments from the air freight companies operating out of John F. Kennedy Airport. Vario died in May of 1988 at the age of 73. Dying in prison was the thing that Paul Vario feared the most, and he experienced just that. Vincent Asaro, now a capo in the Bonanno crime family, was charged by the FBI as being part of the Lufthansa robbery in 2014. This conviction was based solely on the testimony of an embittered witness who was also Asaro's own cousin. A jury found him not guilty, however, and he walked away a free man. On April the 13th, 1996, Jimmy the Gent Burke died of cancer at Wendy Correctional Facility in Alden, New York. He was 64 years old. Lewis Werner, the inside man who was the original creator of the idea that would morph into the Lufthansa heist, actually had the happiest ending of everyone who was involved in the robbery. In a twist of irony, and after spending his first year in prison, Werner decided that he didn't like it in prison and couldn't do another 14 years of time. His lawyer reached out to DA Ed McDonald to say that he would now like to cooperate. Werner had a slight problem, though. Namely, with Joe Manry and Martin Krugman both being dead, Werner had no direct connection to Jimmy Burke, which meant that he had nothing valuable to give investigators in 1980. But Werner really wanted to get out of prison. It really wasn't his cup of tea, you see. So his lawyer issued a press release. It stated that Louis Werner was now cooperating with law enforcement. The publicity it attracted forced the government's hand to reduce Werner's sentence from 15 to 5 years. Once he was released, Werner was reunited with his girlfriend, Janet Barbieri, and they were placed into the witness protection program. It is believed that Lewis Werner eventually passed away in 2007 while living under an assumed identity in Oklahoma. Peter Grunewald also entered the witness protection program after testifying against Werner, but his fate is unknown to this day. The bodies of Tommy DeSimone, Martin Krugman, Louis Cafora, and his wife Joanna have never been found. The money and jewels that were stolen on December the 11th, 1978, have also never been recovered. But just because they haven't been recovered doesn't mean that someone didn't spend them somewhere. After all, the cash was untraceable. Henry Hill died on June the 12th, 2012, at the age of 69 in Los Angeles, California. His cause of death was reported as being heart disease, caused by a lifetime of smoking, alcohol and narcotics abuse. Following Hill's entry into the witness protection program and life after the mafia, Hill had a number of run-ins with the law, but his later life, from the late 1980s onwards, was primarily focused on exploiting his story and inside knowledge of being a gangster in the Italian mafia. I'm going to end tonight's episode with a quote from Henry Hill, taken from the book Wise Guy, about his time in the mob. Quote, "At the age of 12, my ambition was to become a gangster, to be a wise guy. Being a wise guy was better than being president of the United States. To be a wise guy was to own the world."
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.